Okay, welcome back to another episode of Gender Troubles. I'm Emma.
I'm Eva.
And we study gender studies so you don't have to. Or we majored in women's studies so you don't have to. That's the tagline, right?
It's something like that.
It's something
like that. We did it, you get to not do it and just listen to us instead.
Exactly. So Eva, as you know, Canada Day is on July 1st this year.
Is it always on July 1st or is it one of those? Okay, it's not one of those holidays where it's like the 8th.
No, I don't know why I specified this year. It's always on July 1st. but there's a lot of movement this year around canceling it because of recent findings of mass graves and unmarked graves at former residential schools in Canada. And sort of the nation is having a bit of a reckoning with the fact that, you know, we have been complicit in attempted genocide for literally since the inception of Canada. So in the spirit of doing a kind of anti-Canada Day act, I want to talk today about Emily Murphy.
Okay.
Who Emily Murphy is?
I do not know who Emily Murphy is.
Well, get ready. Okay, so let's jump right in. So as you know, I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, which is in Western Canada. And Edmonton sits on the banks of the North Saskatchewan River. And on the northern bank of the river, by Edmonton's oldest bridge, sits Emily Murphy Park, which is complete with a large statue of her. And Emily Murphy was a famous feminist who has been remembered in history books for paving the way for Canadian women to become legal persons. She is revered in Canada, Canadian curriculums as part of the Famous Five. And the Famous Five was a group of five women who advocated for women's rights, women's right to be appointed to the Senate in the early 20th century.
Okay. She was
an author and a judge and an activist and had a very prolific career in a time when most women did not. There are parks and statues named after Murphy all over Canada, especially in Alberta, where a good amount of her work took place. And the statue of Murphy in Edmonton has been the topic of recent controversy, with many calling for it to be torn down due to Murphy's history as a white supremacist and a eugenicist. So in this anti-Canada Day special episode, we're going to speak about Emily Murphy and this sort of convergence of feminism and racism and ableism and white nationalism and eugenics.
Mm.
So just a little content warning. The episode deals with like some really disturbing content around eugenics and racism and ableism and forced sterilization. And I want to be conscious of the fact that like also like Black and Indigenous people, like this is not news to them. And so I feel like our target audience for this is really like settlers in Canada and white people. And I understand if like this content is not for everyone and it shouldn't be for everyone. But you know, if you are a white settler that doesn't understand necessarily the long history of white supremacy and eugenics in Canada, I encourage you to take a listen.
Mm-hmm.
Emily Murphy was born in Cookstown, Ontario in 1868, and she was born into a very prominent and wealthy family that included politicians and lawyers and newspaper owners and Supreme Court justices. She married and moved to Edmonton with her husband and two children in 1907, and she was a popular writer, adopting the pen name Janie Canuck and writing personal reflections on Canadian life. Or she became very invested in issues facing women and children, namely that women had no legal right to own property, which meant if their husbands left them or died, they had no right to their home or property.
Mm.
So her political advocacy gained momentum and support of other women. And in 1911, she pressured the Alberta government to pass the Dower Act, which provided a wife the right to 1/3 of property owned by her husband. So that's pretty good, right?
That's not too bad.
Yeah, 1/3. It's all right.
You get the bathroom and the kitchen.
Exactly. So her political engagement continued in Alberta, and she was pretty successful at it, which was uncommon for women in this era, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
She could often be found advocating for the rights of women and children in Alberta courtrooms and was eventually made a police magistrate, which was sort of like a low-ranking judge. And she was the first woman in the British Empire to be made a magistrate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she has like a really impressive career. And in 1929, she was part of the Famous Five, which was a group of five women. It was like Nellie McClung, Louise McKinney, Emily Murphy, and two others whose name I can't remember. And they won what was called the Persons Case. And this case challenged a portion of the Canadian Constitution that denied women the chance to be a part of the Canadian Senate. So after many appeals, the Famous Five won the case, and the first woman, Corrine Wilson, was named to the Canadian Senate. As a judge, Emily witnessed a lot of what she called societal ills that she felt were a direct result of drugs coming into Canada in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And in 1922, she wrote a book about it called The Black Candle. I'm going to show you the cover of this book, and you can tell me what you think the main argument in this book was.
Okay, let me see. Oh, wow.
So I'll describe it for listeners.
Okay.
It says, The Black Candle, Canada's first book on drug abuse, 1922.
It's in a very dark red, orange, and black color palette that makes it seem kind of devilish.
Yes,
very strange. Some swirly Art Nouveau font and what looks like a racist caricature of an Asian man smoking a pipe, and behind him is what I'm gonna assume is a woman, mm-hmm. for her argument probably a white woman, who is naked and being kind of engulfed in hands that are also flames.
Exactly. So yeah, you can probably, I'll link an image of this into the show notes so people can take a look at it. But yes, you're spot on. That is an extremely racist caricature of an East Asian man. And in The Black Candle, Emily Murphy takes issue with the drug trade present in Canada at the beginning of the 20th century, which was, and her main concern was opium, although mm-hmm. she was also concerned with other drugs.
And is this a novel or a nonfiction?
It's nonfiction. And it's basically like a series of articles that were eventually compiled into a book.
Okay.
And she's talking about, yeah, like she talks about like cocaine and the drug trade and policing. And it's just like an opinion piece, I guess, on like the drug trade in Canada and how to resolve it.
Okay.
And yeah, she, throughout her writing in this book, she places the blame on Chinese Canadian men for the presence of drugs, and especially the presence of opium in Canada. And she presents white women as the victims of this industry.
Mm-hmm.
So Murphy uses the drug trade kind of as a vehicle to advocate for her eugenics-based nationalist agenda, and stresses the importance of establishing a Canadian state full of, quote, ideal citizens, i.e. one that is white and drug-free.
Mm-hmm.
So she writes a lot about the fear of white slavery or white slave traffic. And I just wanted to define those terms. So these were terms used to describe a moral panic common through the early 20th century, and it describes coercive prostitution in this time period, and the emphasis on it being white slavery was because the term was used by white people in a context of the fear of white women being corrupted and lured mainly by men of color into mm-hmm. drugs and prostitution.
There is a musical set around this time, the 1920s, called Thoroughly Modern Millie, which has some fun music numbers and a whole subplot about the quote-unquote white slave trade, in which this woman, this Asian woman who's owns like a kind of boarding house, takes these white women and sells them, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the musical a few times because I was not very popular in high school. And every time I was like, wow, they're still keeping that whole subplot. Yeah. It was very in the popular culture of the 20s.
There's lots of movies that like center around this kind of theme too. It was just a really it was a moral panic that really permeated popular culture and policy. So just I guess to get a bit of like background as to like where this moral panic sort of like stemmed from, in the early 20th century when Emily Murphy wrote The Black Candle, Western Canada was seeing a huge influx of immigrants. There was great government incentive to settle the West, i.e. dispossess Indigenous people of their land. And the Canadian government was giving away land to new immigrants to farm. And, you know, advertising jobs abroad, like they were really telling people to come to Canada. And the Canadian state relied heavily on cheap labor of immigrants in order to settle the West. But the influx of immigrants created a huge moral panic among white bourgeois Canadians. Hence, moral reformers such as Murphy blamed the ills of society such as drugs as a direct result of immigration. So according to the Simon Fraser University Chinese Canadian Historical Foundation, most Chinese people immigrated to Canada during this time for the same reason as most people did, to earn a better salary and live a better life. But upon arrival, faced the burden of being segregated. Asian men were forced to make wages that were one half of unskilled white men in their same field. And a head tax was also imposed in 1885 for every Chinese immigrant, which added additional financial burden and prevented individuals from bringing family members over. And there were really strict immigration policies, which severely limited the ability for Chinese women to come to Canada. So all of this resulted in incredible social isolation, significant economic struggle, and Chinese Canadians were subject to forced poverty, social isolation, and were limited in terms of forging community and kinship ties as a direct result of these policies. In The Black Candle, Murphy argued that it was the common goal of, quote, aliens of color to bring about the degeneration of the white race, end quote, via addiction, which is in alignment with other histrionics used by early 20th century feminism, for sure.
And you still see that today with conversations around the opioid crisis and the kind of fear around like fentanyl being imported from China. It erases the nuances of addiction, for one thing, regardless of what your race is, and then also makes it seem as if drugs and all the bad things that come with it are just coming from outside, from the other. And it centers white victimhood over and over and over again.
Yeah, you actually touched on a point that I was going to mention at the end, but like it's interesting how like these anti-Asian sentiments of like the white ruling class in Canada have like permeated our culture and continue to, especially in Western Canada. Like there's a lot of talk of like this fear of Chinese people like buying up lots of property in downtown Vancouver and like, oh, we have to put a stop to this, you know, or yes, like it's Chinese people who are bringing over fentanyl and these like total myths that, you know, like, you know, if you're concerned about property costs in Vancouver and, you know, the accumulation of property and wealth, then maybe your critique should lay with capitalism and not with racism.
And I think this also, we both have a lot of thoughts and opinions around the whole kind of panic around sex trafficking that ties into, you know, how sex workers are treated. And I know in a few other episodes, we're going to break down kind of what's going on there and how feminism reacts and interacts with sex work being both like as a valid form of work and also trying to kind of, you know, abolish it. And so this aspect of Emily Murphy of this kind of using this specter of this trafficked white woman is a really great way to kind of couch whatever your real agenda is, which for hers is just, you know, racism and eugenics. Exactly. And I could see, like, in terms of being a strategy, that's a great strategy to bring your trash policies to light. Mm-hmm. And again, you see that with the ways that kind of Republicans and people who don't seem to actually really care about, you know, vulnerable people and sexual assault or anything like that, suddenly get up in arms when you talk about the trafficked young girl.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's such a facade. But it, yeah, it's interesting how it's still such an effective talking point. Yeah. There was such fear of the fraternization of white women and East Asian men that laws such as the White Women's Labor Law passed in Saskatchewan, which prevented white women from working in establishments owned by East Asian men.
Jesus Christ.
I know. It's wild. So in a more global context, the 1904 International Agreement for the Suppression of White Slave Traffic stated the victim it sought to protect was the, quote, white woman, victim of the animal lust of the dark races, end quote.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So again, this was a time when nationalist projects of preserving whiteness were at the forefront of feminist agendas and were backed by law and did not attempt to hide what they were doing at all. It was quite obvious. So Murphy's obsessive focus on Chinese men also came during a time when miscegenation laws appeared throughout the United States. These laws made interracial relationships illegal and often portrayed white women as falling victim to men of color, requiring state law to keep them safe from the predatory other, big air quotes there. Murphy's texts are well situated in the anxiety of miscegenation law, which ensured segregation on a marital level and thus the preservation of whiteness. And while there were no anti-miscegenation laws in Canada, Constance Backhouse writes that there were cases of Chinese men being arrested for proposing marriage or marrying white women during this time. And she provides the example of a man in Diamond, Alberta, who proposed to a white woman at his workplace and was arrested. So it's not hyperbolic at all to say that Emily Murphy advocated for eugenics. In The Black Candle, she warns of the potential of, this is awful, but she warns of the potential of, quote, half-caste infants born from interracial relationships between white women and East Asian men, stating that this is a threat to the supremacy of the Anglo-Saxon this is a threat to supremacy of Anglo-Saxons. So she was really not beating around the bush at all. White supremacy was the goal. The Canadian white nation state was the goal. And she advocated for segregation, strict immigration policy, and eugenics to achieve this. And I found this really interesting, actually. In the book, Canadian History Post-Confederation, John Douglas Belshaw dedicated a whole chapter to the Canadian eugenics movement in which Emily Murphy was featured. And he calls her a maternal feminist, which was a popular term for feminists of this era who, quote, elevated motherhood to women's highest calling and thus concerned itself heavily with the fertility of those considered unfit to mother, which made this type of maternal feminism and the eugenics movement kind of really vibe with one another.
That kind of ties into last week's episode too, around liberal feminism and how feminism at this time was so tied to kind of being a good mother and being a good spouse, and we needed feminism so women could be those better, like, domestic maternal things.
Exactly. Yeah. It's definitely, this is like a very good example, I think, of liberal feminism in the works. So before we go into the next section, I just wanted to define some terms around eugenics. Mm-hmm. So eugenics was a set of beliefs and practices aimed at improving the human population through controlled breeding. It really gained popularity in the early 20th century and is now debunked, considered by most to be total pseudoscience, but it is still practiced in certain more insidious ways, such as the course of sterilization of Indigenous women in Canada that does continue. or the practice of screening fetuses for certain diseases and encouraging abortion.
Yeah, I there's definitely, I've read a few pieces kind of looking at, yeah, this project of kind of very aggressive screening before a baby is born. And yeah, it is definitely still, you know, by definition, a form of eugenics, but I think a lot of people first assume like anything Nordic is better somehow. Like people who think the Nordic model is the best way to deal with, you know, issues within like sex workers' rights. And then the minute you kind of break it down, you're like, oh, that's actually not that great. Like IKEA furniture, it is shaky. But yeah, I think when we talk about you know, mental health and people with disabilities and cognitive disabilities, specifically people who don't necessarily are given that much of a platform in discussions around, you know, disability justice or, you know, what is considered a good, fruitful life. I find it's really fascinating how we don't, as a culture that kind of thinks of it being kind of progressive and not holding on to these things like eugenics from the past, it's still really evident. Another great example, not to bring it back to Britney Spears, but to bring it back to Britney Spears and the testimony she gave last week, where she shared during the conservatorship hearings that she has an IUD has an IUD placed inside of her that she does not want, and she wants to have more children. And it's a very common tactic for people who are institutionalized for their release or for various different things, and just shows how reproductive justice and disability justice really go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Similar things have come out recently in Canada regarding medical treatment of really, really young Indigenous girls in Canada and sort of coercive placement of IUDs in girls as young as 12, 13.
Mm-hmm. I feel like white women, when we think about reproductive justice, we think a lot about like the right to abortion and to birth control. And there's this whole other facet of, you know, the right to get pregnant and to carry a pregnancy to term and to, you know, be given good pre and postnatal care. Mm-hmm. And it's another way that, you know, the specific issues that disproportionately affect, you know, Black women, Indigenous women, women of color, get kind of erased from the larger feminist conversations around, you know, who is allowed to, you know, be pregnant and what is considered the desired pregnant person.
Absolutely, yeah. So two other eugenics terms, or three, sorry. So we have positive eugenics, which is a form of eugenics that encourages the procreation of individuals and groups who are viewed as possessing desirable characteristics and genes. So methods would include like baby bonuses and other financial incentives. And then there's negative eugenics, a form of eugenics that discourages and decreases the procreation of individuals and groups who are viewed as having inferior or undesirable characteristics and genes. So methods would include sexual sterilization and institutionalization. Mm-hmm. And then sterilization is a permanent medical procedure that prevents pregnancy. One example is tubal ligation, a surgical procedure in which the fallopian tubes are either cut or blocked to prevent ovulation. Mm-hmm. So through the 1920s and 30s, Emily Murphy's support of eugenics intensified and specifically targeted individuals who were institutionalized or suffering from mental illness or cognitive disabilities. She believed selective sterilization would solve many societal problems, such as drug use, which she felt was linked to mental or cognitive disability. Due to her strong campaigning and garnering of public support, the Sexual Sterilization Act was passed in Alberta in 1928, which was Canada's first sterilization law, which I actually didn't know about prior to researching this episode. Yeah. So I'm going to read a little quote from the Eugenics Archive in Canada. It was an article written by Sheila Gibbons. Aligned with commonly held beliefs that civilization would decline without stricter social controls, Women involved in the eugenics movement argued that reform could only happen through cooperative state action rather than be driven by individual interests. In addition to being a prominent political figure in equal rights legislation, Murphy was also a vital contributor to programs which sought to improve the human race through the forced sterilization of those deemed unfit. Though Murphy believed that insanity should not be treated as a crime, as magistrate, she was frequently exposed to what she believed were the social problems arising out of insanity. So drunkenness, criminality, prostitution, illegitimacy. She was a staunch advocate for state-sanctioned sterilization and was one of the key proponents in arousing favorable public opinion. She feared that the general public, which was in complete ignorance of this menace and constantly reinforced the necessity of sterilization by providing examples from court cases she had witnessed. Campaigning primarily for the sterilization of young, so-called feeble-minded girls, with the support of her suffragist partner, MLA Nellie McClung, Murphy's actions were critical to gain the support required for the passage of the Sexual Sterilization Act in 1928. So according to Sheila Gibbons, over 2,800 people were sterilized under this act, and the law was not repealed until 1972.
Wow.
And actually during World War II, you'd think that, you know, there would be some reflection upon what was happening in the world and perhaps the, you know, the repeal of this act, but no, it was actually expanded to target more populations during World War II. So, yeah. And then this is another quote from that same article. In 1932, Murphy published an article titled "Overpopulation and Birth Control." In this article, Murphy argues that the world was overpopulated and the root of world problems, including war, could be traced back to overpopulation. For Murphy, eugenics was a means of containing overpopulation and therefore a means for peace. Mm. So it was really interesting because, I mean, she made her so-called feminist career off of advocating for, like, you know, that women are persons and that they deserve to have one third of their property owned by their husbands, or that they deserve to, you know, be part of the Canadian Senate because, you know, they are persons and they have stakes in this democracy and in this country and in this nation. But it's such a weird break in logic to then go from that to, but we should also forcibly sterilize certain women.
What's happening with the statue?
So there's a change.org petition to have it removed. And thus far there has been no movement from Edmonton City Council or the mayor to remove it. But yeah, it's people are asking for it to be taken down. So in conclusion, Emily Murphy is often remembered as one of the most important feminists in Canadian history. And if her statue is to remain up in spots across the country, I would recommend the plaque be amended to the following. Emily Murphy, 1868 to 1933. White supremacist, eugenicist, proto-fascist. To have her statue on a podium in a park is to provide a literal platform to these values. So we should just tear that shit down.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, like learning about her in grade school. And like, I guess again, yeah, like how your feminism changes over time. And I remember learning about her and like going to the park being like, yeah, I'm a woman and she was a powerful woman. And the narrative I think needs to be retold, which I hope we have helped do in this episode. Okay, so that is it for our Anti-Canada Day special today.
Next week, we're going to talk about neoliberal feminism and girl bosses. Yes. So put on your pink pussy hats and your she believed she could, so she did t-shirts. And we will see you next week.
Heck yeah. Okay, see you next week.